nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Well, we're going to talk about one or two things today, and hopefully I can get through them in reasonable amount of time. And at the end, I'm going to make some propositions about how to rewrite the theory of plasmonics so that a lot of the talk that we've been hearing can be clarified in a way that was clarified actually 30 years ago. I'm sorry to have to say that, but it was. Okay. So the objectives are to get some kind of control, to bring in some nonlinearity, and I want to just look at vortices, concentrators, and at the very end, I'm talking with a companion in Edmonton who used to work here, Zubin Jacob, and he's sent me one or two slides on spatial dispersion, so we hope to include that at the end. Power control is a wonderful thing, and you can actually use it to control the stopping of light, and we had some work on trapped rainbows a while ago, but we're not going to talk about that today, but we can now add nonlinearity into this to get some power control. So the first thing I want to do is to look at a system you've probably seen me talk about before, a waveguide, where the waveguide is divided up into parts of NPM, negative phase medium, and PPM, positive phase medium. And we're going to attempt to control the diffraction of a beam that's propagating as shown here. And the diffraction is going to be allowed only in the sideways direction here. I don't want to spend time going into the nonlinear Schrodinger equation and all that kind of thing. I assume that everybody here is well-versed in that sort of thing. But basically, if you take a slowly varying amplitude, say for a beam propagating in a waveguide, you'll end up with something called the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. And one of the terms involves diffraction. And it always looks like, if A is the amplitude, it always looks like D2A dx squared, which is the amplitude, and immediately you can bring in some metamaterial influence here because the sign in front of it will be negative if you're dealing with a negative phase medium and positive if it's a positive phase medium. Now what I want to do is to say, right, if you take this plus and minus term here, let's just replace this by some parameter D, and D is going to give me some idea of how to control the diffraction. Now, where am I going to get the value of D from? Well, you have to take my word for it that the little diagram that I just showed to you with plus PPM, NPM going all the way along the waveguide, if I take an average of that over each unit cell as I go down, I can come up with a value for D that could be, if there's nothing there except PPM, it'll just be 100%. If there's nothing there but NPM, it'll be 100%. But if there's more than one type of material there, I could get D to be some value that's down to 10%, for example. And so, in that way, we should be able to manage the diffraction. At the end of the day, you could say, right, well, if you kill the diffraction, then you've left yourself only with the nonlinearity, and no diffraction is left. But that's not actually true, because if you take the Schrodinger equation and develop it properly, you will find that you get another nonlinear term, which is called nonlinear diffraction. And this involves the beam width, it involves the wave number, which makes it also metamaterial dependent. And so as you lose the linear diffraction, you will gain something on the nonlinear diffraction. Now, some people will argue, when they're playing with the Schrodinger equation, that non-parabolicity and various other terms will come in. Well, I can assure you this is not the case, that this is always dominant, and I regret not to put a reference in here, but I think we showed this 12 years ago, that this is a dominant term in the system. And it's also metamaterial dependent. So what do we get out of it then? Well, if we look here, we can see the PPM, NPM, we can see diffraction management here. But suddenly, if I emerge into even a full NPM medium here, I lose the diffraction control that I had. But if I add in a magnetic field pointing in this direction, I can actually use a substrate that's magneto-optic. So if I switch off the magneto-optic behavior and have, say, D equals 10%, in other words, I've diffraction managed this very well right up to this point, and suddenly it's gone up to 100%, the whole beam disappears and I've lost it. If I add in a magnetic field here, what I do is to create a potential well. That's what the magneto-optic influence does, creates a potential well in this region here, and I capture the beam here, even though it's 100%. Now, you've got to imagine what would you want this for. There's all kinds of applications that you might want to do in terms of integrated optics that you would find this useful. Right. I'm moving on to my next topic, which is vortices. We've heard about vortices a little bit in the conference already. I just put in a few comments. Some of them are pleasing, some of them are a bit worrying. Leonardo da Vinci said it was the last wave of a dying heart, but that's probably not what you want to hear. It's also the red spot on Jupiter is actually a vortex. And oddly enough, and very interesting for us all, by the way, is that the radio echoes from the Antarctic ice sheets, which Nye and Berry got in 1974, they were doing a project nothing to do with optics. They weren't talking about anything that we were even remotely interested in. And yet, the technique that they got out of it actually is quite vital for us to understand how vortices behave in optical materials. So we've got to look around. Even now, maybe people are doing things that we think, well, that's not interesting, but maybe it is. Maybe it is. And so, what do we get then? Suppose I take the basic equation, which is, as I said, the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. Suppose I put in an excitation U, and I write this as X plus I times Y, and I have some quantity M here, etc., and I multiply the whole thing by a Gaussian form. If I take the phase that this line implies, it's very simple. Tan phi is the imaginary part of U over the real part of U. But when I go to X equals 0 and Y equals 0, I can't calculate the phase. Oh, so I've done something wrong. No, we haven't done anything wrong. What we've done is defined something that has what is known as a singularity. If you find a point in any of the system where you cannot define the phase, then this is singular. Now you think, I've never seen anything like this. And we can see that if I look at the phase, it varies like this as I go around 2 pi. And here I've got a hole in the middle, which implies the x equals 0, y equals 0. There's nothing there. Here's my Gaussian envelope here. And I've got something that reminds me of something. And you think, ah, yes, I know what this reminds me of. It's a vortex. It looks like a vortex. Now you think, when did I last see a vortex? Well, it depends on your hygiene, of course. If you take baths, you'll have seen one. If you take showers, you might not have seen one for a while. But when they take the plug out and the water goes down the plug, it goes around and around like this. And you can see that there's where the actual plug is, there's nothing there. That's the line of singularity, and that's a vortex. And this is what the optical one is. And the phase form, looks like this. And you can think, well, this is very modern. In actual fact, it isn't very modern. It was done by someone whose name I forget in 1911 by hand, who was talking about some mathematical problem they were interested in. They published it in a mathematical journal. Right. What Nye and Berry did in the Antarctic, they actually looked at the vortex like this and said, if I fire a plane wave through the vortex, I'm going to get an interference pattern. And where you get a break in the interference pattern is exactly where the singularity is. So he knew then that when they were looking in the Antarctic ice sheets, they were finding singularities just by this technique. But they weren't, of course, interested in vortices at the time. They were interested in dislocations in the ice sheets. But nevertheless, this is the technique that they used. So if I look at diffraction managed vortices, then if I put D equals 1, which is the no diffraction management, then as the vortex progresses from Z equals 0 to, these are all dimensionless quantities, to 0.8 to 1.6, you see that it spreads out a bit, which is what you expect a bit. And if I look at this one here down to 0.3, I can see I can control this, and what's more, I can get quite a degree of confinement here of the actual vortex. And so, if I look at nonlinear vortices, I get the similar kind of patterns. I can see I've got my dislocations here in the interference pattern that I mentioned to you. And it's all very beautiful. And even if you weren't interested in anything, this is just beautiful to play with anyway. They're just nice pictures. So what else can be done in terms of diffraction management? Well, we can have a pair of vortices, for example, which are spinning around each other. And if this is 100%, this is what happens. And you can see that we've got something interesting. But if I drop the diffraction down so that I reduce it to 20%, then I can see that I can change the rotation of the vortices around me. Now, what are we saying here? We're saying that I can take something like a vortex, which is very interesting and has quite a lot of practical applications, and I could see how I could introduce the influence of a metamaterial into the system by just using some form of diffraction management here. So the conclusion then is that diffraction management creates vortices. For a vortex pair, the diffraction manages to change the rotation. Now, if I go to how really to put in magneto-optics, the well-known configurations are here, which I won't dwell too long on. This is the various orientations, and they come under the classic names of longitudinal, polar, and transverse, or Kerr effect. And it's well known that if you introduce magneto-optics into your guiding material, and by the way, I think our field, our metamaterial field, and other materials that the conference I go to, there's nowhere near enough talk about magneto-optics. Magneto-optics is talked about as if it's something strange. But I'm sorry, but if you're a magnetism person, and you're going to see even to this year's international conference on magnetism, there'll be two full parallel sessions on magneto-optics. And they're already being used in many devices. And I think we should take much more advantage of this. So, that's what we're getting here. And for tunability, we can use guides, waveguides, and I can use either electric field applied through a pump wave, or again, magneto-optics. I can use magneto-optics to change the group velocity in terms of the thickness of the guide. So we have a lot of opportunity for power, and many guides will come. And so the magneto-optic case, well, it's just my way of putting it. I'm not a practical person, so I'm proposing we would devise something like this for our vortices to propagate in. And we use electric wires and current distribution, but let's not worry too much about it. And so if I look at, I don't know whether we've got that. If I look at D equals 20% and I apply a magnetic field, in other words, put my vortices in the presence of magneto-optic influence, I can actually show that the well created by the magnetic field actually causes the vortex to become unstable because the potential well is created. And what happens is that the two vortices dissolve into two spatial solitons. So the spatial soliton was secretly the vortex was secretly a soliton at this point. But when I put the magneto-optic influence, I managed to bring it out of its shell.
What is the scale of these vortices?
Sorry?
What is the characteristic scale of these vortices?
You mean what size?
Yes.
Well, it depends on what you want to do. I mean, there will be in the micron region, yes. Yeah.
We need vortices for nanoscale.
Yeah.
For technology, yeah. For STT, yeah. For example, we have
yeah.
20 to 20 yeah. nanometers
yeah.
that we could resolve.
I think you can put them into the scale that you want to. It depends how you choose your materials. That's the clue. So, when magneto-optics is applied to the outcome, etc., we can get a bright soliton pair out of it. Now, come to something. What time do I have? 10 minutes? Yeah. Come to something that we've been doing very recently, for which we have actually submitted a paper to a journal I was advised probably isn't going to be the best journal, but never mind. Are you listening? Are you listening, Eugenie? Are you listening? What I said about the journal. Anyway, we won't mention which one it was. Okay, right. So it's a journal that now insists that it must be of national importance. It must be involved social change. It must involve your grandmother and various other people. Otherwise, it doesn't fit. But if the abstract contains all these criteria, it gets passed without them reading the paper. It's a different life we live now. Okay, so what we're looking at, we picked up the paper, this beautiful paper by Eugenie from some years ago, where he was looking at a concentrator. And so that's just the diagram here. Sorry we didn't give you a reference there, it's just... I probably wasn't feeling too hospitable when I did the slide. No, just a joke. And we're going to look at the possibility of creating hotspots. Now, what's the idea? The idea is, instead of just creating a black hole and letting the rays go into the center, I'm going to make the center nonlinear. And what's more, I do not have to, although this is omnidirectional, I don't have to accept all light coming. If I was using this as a practical device, I can shield part of it and just have a few rays coming in from the side. And these rays I can use for special purposes. So what happens is, if I just take a few rays coming in, and I keep the core linear, it looks like that, then if I make the core nonlinear, begins to look like that, and then suddenly I get a big hot spot. You see the scale's gone up to 19 on the left here. This is going to be a massive hot spot which is going to develop inside the core of the device. Now you could imagine lots of medical applications for this, with creating hot spots for special purposes, and so that's what it essentially is going to look like. But of course, if the rays come in from all directions, the hot spots will form all around the core and it won't be as interesting for us to use. We also are looking at the possibility of using a hyperbolic metamaterial. I know that Zubin and co. have been looking at this kind of device, but they wanted to use it as a lens. I'm just turning it around. I think some of the early work of our colleague Zhang, where he took the light from inside and it went outside and eventually became normal and he picked it up. I'm just taking the light in the other direction. And some of these layers are going to be made into nonlinear collectors. And so, again, we get nice hotspots. We think that this is quite an important development, so that's why we've written it up recently. The You can add magneto-optics, or you can add an external electric field. You can change the position of the hot spots inside the core. But you could imagine building a device whereby you really are wanting to expose things to very high intensities, more so than just ordinary focusing. You can do this just by using the collector properties. Right, we'll come to the last part of what I want to say. This is more like a preacher now, I'm sorry, but we're going to... we've heard a lot about non-locality, we've heard a lot about plasmonics, etc., etc. What I'm saying is that what people have not recognizing in our field, perhaps, is I don't think anyone has used the word cold yet in this meeting, that everybody is picking up formulae which are cold plasma formulae.
Have been outside yesterday, lots of people.
Sorry? Say again?
You have not been outside yesterday, lots of people.
So, and if we look at that, then you could say, right, well, how can I include spatial dispersion into it? Well, you see the formula I've written down. I think Sir John or somebody wrote them down, showing that there was an extra K dependence coming into the longitudinal component, which is because you're now not treating this as a cold plasma. Now, because it's hard to remember what these guys say sometime, I've kind of scribbled down something I looked up about what is beta. What would you call beta if it's not a cold plasma? And apparently, I mean, years ago, this is not new, that I quote to you, the behavior of an assembly of Fermi particles can be described as a quantized field of sound waves in the Fermi gas. And so beta can be the first velocity of sound. That's what is known as the first velocity of sound. But it is possible, if the frequency becomes much bigger than the collision frequency, that you will move to another velocity of sound, which is called the velocity of zero sound.
Zero sound.
Oh, yeah. Zero. Yeah. 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 So, now, when I look at this, and I look back some of the old work, I'm afraid, I have to admit I was kind of involved with 30 years ago, it doesn't seem difficult to set up a proper theory of the plasma, including non-locality, and then things are taken care of. So if you say, right, why would I want to go to high K? Well, years and years ago, I have to tell you, people weren't interested because they think, well, what do we want high K for? It just, if you take the plasmon dispersion curve, it just takes you out here somewhere. But in actual fact, that's where the resonances are, and that's where the inhomogeneities of the surface come in. But people were not paying attention. They prefer to operate near to the light line. Now, if we set up our theory correctly, we can also take into account that we might, for part of the time, be dealing with a metamaterial. Now, if we're dealing with a metamaterial, then the high K is going to take us out of the effective medium approximation. And Zubin Jacob sent me these diagrams here of the high K waves and hyperbolic metamaterials. And he's talking about how spatial dispersion plays a role, etc., etc. And basically, in a recent paper that they published this year, you can see from here that if you look at the transmission through a system, a metamaterial, then you can see this is the effective medium approximation. It just goes on forever. And you can see that as you go to certain K values, clunk, the whole thing breaks down. And so you're out of the effective medium approximation. Now, there is no reason why a hybrid model couldn't be developed that could actually have part of it operating with the metamaterial and part of it operating to take into account high K effects, spatial dispersion, even though it's actually gone out of the metamaterial regime. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to imagine devices, practical devices that might be, in one part of it, they're taking a measurement. The measurement actually involves high K. So it has to be designed to operate properly in the high K regime. But for a lot of the time, the device may be working in the fairly low K regime, in which case it could be designed using the standard effective medium approximation and take the spatial dispersion out of it. So I just think that somehow we've got a high K region here, we've got the low K region here, and I'm not sure that in the middle we're developing the theory correctly, and I just feel that it's not a big problem. If we stop calling this a cold plasma, I think we will be into the correct regime immediately. And I think the results will be very interesting. Right, so nonlinear magneto-optic control of beams, pulses, vortices, etc., offer exciting horizons. I think many roads need to control. There are very many ways of controlling. Even thermal control is a possibility now. I was reading something very interesting about thermal cloaking, for example. Nonlinear energy concentrators, which is what we're looking at, look very promising. And spatial dispersion, I've just introduced this as a comment about the future, that there's no reason why we cannot include spatial dispersion in everything we do and not be afraid of it, because it's not exactly a new topic. It's just that we are the new guys in town and we should use it. Thank you.